seated, everyone. Our next case is case number 56881, Nevada Power Company versus Three Kids LLC. Mr. Perry representing the appellant, Ms. Harrop representing the respondent. Chief Justice Pickering has recused from participating in this case, so we'll conduct it with the Sixth Justice Court. So, Mr. Perry, you may proceed.
Members of this court, I'm pleased to be here today. Thank you very much for having me en banc. I haven't done this before in the Nevada Supreme Court. I haven't argued a case in front of the Nevada Supreme Court for quite a while. Grateful to be here, though. I'd like to recognize Ms. Harrop, who was in the trial with us, a wonderful attorney. Glad to be here with you. Also with me at counsel table are Heidi Stern and Tim Mulliner, who wrote the brief, so if you find problems with that, you can blame them. Let me just start that off. There are two arguments that we'd like to make here, two issues that we think are prominent. First of all, we believe that the Tammy Kemp prepared sales analysis was flawed and created a prejudicial error. Secondly, we believe one of the jury instructions, instruction 35, was erroneous, clearly erroneous, misstated the law of the state of Nevada, and both of these two errors require that a new trial be held in this matter. I'd like to address the paired sales analysis first. It's more factually bound, but still I think the record is quite complete with respect to the paired sales analysis. As the court is undoubtedly aware, that the paired sales analysis is a specialized technique used by appraisers, where they isolate one factor and then try to determine how that factor compares with the different sales. In this particular case, the factor that Ms. Campbell was identifying is power lines, high-tension power lines on one property, and the lack of high-tension power lines on another property. The problem with the paired sales analysis is that in her report, her original appraisal report that she prepared, it was totally inadequate for that purpose to demonstrate a paired sales analysis. None of the sales that she identified in her report had an APN number, had an address, identified the seller, identified the buyer.
Mr. Perry, doesn't that go to the weight of the evidence as opposed to its admissibility or its presentation? I mean, as you pointed out, this is largely a factual determination, so I'm a little bit concerned about what you're asking us to do.
Thank you, and I appreciate that question. I'll go right to it then now that you've raised it. The problem with that is this is expert testimony, Your Honor, and this is paired sales analysis. And paired sales analysis requires that it meet the standards that an expert would have in this type of situation. And that is, in order for paired sales analysis to be admissible, it has to isolate the one factor. And the failure to include any of these things in the appraisal reports violates 16.1. Because in order to have us be able to even evaluate this report, we need this fundamental information at the very beginning. And we did hire an expert to review this report, and he came back, Mr. Oral Anderson, and said, this is totally inadequate. It violates USPAP.
So why wasn't there some pretrial practice on this matter as opposed to appearing before us at this juncture?
You're on the spot. I guess I've only got a little bit of time, but I'll go right to that then, too. Secondly, Your Honor, the problem is that I did take the deposition. And while they say I didn't ask about it, that's just not true. I asked, where is this information? She says, it's in the work file. I said, you know, I have a brief in the work file. It's not in the work file. None of this information is in that work file. And so that's where it sits, Your Honor. It's not in the work file. It's not in the report. It's not going to be admissible. I'm comfortable with that position. Is it my duty to make their appraisal report admissible? Don't they have a duty under Rule 26 to supplement if they think it's inadequate? So what happens in this case is we come to trial. And they begin to testify about the paired sales analysis. I object vehemently. I go through these very arguments again. We don't have the APN. We don't have the seller. Now, my expert admittedly has said these could be the sales in his work files. But he's not going to give me that information because there's not enough information. And they have failed to totally supplement anything in the record that justifies this. In fact, what's offensive is, frankly, from my point of view, is that the appraiser says to me in the deposition, that's not my job to tell you this information. It's your job to find it out. That's what the record says. Of course, when I go to trial on this kind of a record, I would hope that the judge would do an evaluation of if this information was really there. Unfortunately, the court in this case said, well, she said, you said. The problem with that is that we have the very document that's in the record that they prepared at trial to say that I received. This is appendix document 2196. But you'll notice it's not date stamped. They have to admit that there is no formal production of this document that now shows me at trial what the APN numbers are. This is the first time that I know what the APN numbers are or what the address is at trial. We have a big hearing. I filed a motion to exclude it at that point. We have an argument. The judge says, she said, you said, she says you received this information. But the record is clear. I did not in any formal way receive this information. So all of the rules of expert production are violated. Rule 16.1 is violated. Rule 26 is violated. Now, Rule 37 is violated, which says that you can't induce this kind of information if it hasn't been previously disclosed. So from our point of view, we accept the ruling of the court, move forward with the trial, and we now send our experts out to gather information about these paired cells analysis that demonstrate to us that the paired cells analysis is fatally flawed, that the properties are not properly compared, they are not, they do not isolate power lines against power lines, and thus our expert is ready to testify that even in a fundamental way, the expert has overinflated the properties that were burdened with the cells because she used a net cells versus gross cells analysis, thus causing an inflation of value. And so I'm ready to present that to the court. The court says, interestingly enough, that that's a violation of the rules of evidence because we did not disclose that before court. Now, the record to us is clear. That could not have been done. We could not have disclosed that before court. Then we tried to get in the video deposition that we had taken of Ms. Campa, demonstrating her line of questioning and her statements with respect to this document and this position. Once again, the judge felt that we could not introduce the video because she was there present in court and ready to be cross-examined and examined, even though we felt it was one substantive and certainly went to the weight of her testimony and was denied us that opportunity.
So you're trying to use the video deposition for impeachment?
I would have to admit that the record is not 100% clear, Your Honor, that we wanted to put in the video deposition at the very beginning to demonstrate from our point of view that Ms. Campa was avoiding our questions and evading our questions at the deposition.
Okay.
That would be our theory. I'll talk about prejudice in a minute, but I want to take a little time to talk about Jury Instruction 35. Jury Instruction 35 essentially says that when you determine the fair market value, you have to value the parcel as a whole and not put lesser value on a portion based upon any government restrictions. This particular jury instruction is contrary to established Nevada law and, frankly, condemnation and appraisal law, because it says that a pre-existing condition cannot be used to devalue or lesser the value of the taking. Our theory was that our appraiser put into evidence was that the value of the front strip along the northern part of the property was not diminished very much, because there was already an existing required setback by the Clark County. And therefore, when we put our power lines in that setback, that's where they were established, we were not taking very much value in that particular strip of land, that 5 acres in the front.
Didn't Robinson address that square on, saying you have to value the total property? And this isn't a dedicated easement or right-of-way, so it's a different situation in like Cliff Shadows, a recent case. So tell me why Robinson isn't all fours on this one.
Okay, thank you. I'll just change my notes there again. Okay. Back to there. First of all, Robinson doesn't apply to this case. This is one, a pre-existing setback. Robinson, as you all know, was a situation where the city had not yet taken the property and was trying to take the property. And in Robinson, what happened was the appraiser valued the strip of property around Craig as open space and said it didn't have the highest and best use as commercial, because they were going to have to dedicate that parcel. So the Supreme Court, I think wisely so, said you can't do that. You can't eliminate a discussion about the highest and best use. Well, that didn't happen in our case. The highest and best use, both parties said it was existing industrial with speculative other purposes. Both of the appraisers said that. So the issue about the highest and best use was not at issue in our case. We didn't fundamentally disagree upon that. Where the disagreement was is that our appraiser said the value of that taking is only 10% of the value because it's already an existing setback. The jury came back, I believe, at 70% diminution in value because, first of all, Nevada Power is not taking the whole fee. We are only taking an easement that is coexistent with the existing setback. And so we're not diminishing the usability of that property in any substantial way. The second part that I think distinguishes us is that the law in this state, as far as is established, is that a setback, a zoning, can be used to determine the value of the property. If there's a existing zoning or setback or something, and you're taking the property, for instance, for parking, if that's all you can use, then you really haven't hurt the value of the property if the parking is still allowed. So the worst part of it from our point of view, I think, is that twice in the record, Tammy Campa, the expert witness, said, Mr. Anderson is wrong because the Robinson decision applies in this case, and under the Robinson decision, you can diminish the value of a strip of piece of property. It has to be valued at its, whatever the highest value is, which is incorrect if, in fact, the setback already exists. The second thing is that in Mr. Welch's argument, in closing argument, he specifically cited this jury instruction, and then he berated our expert for having devalued the property, saying you cannot do that. So the prejudice of this jury instruction, which we submit, should not have been given because Robinson is totally inapplicable to our situation, is that the jury was presented with a situation where our expert was called into question in a significant way and was impeached through a misstatement of the law. Secondly, the jury was told that they could not take into account the setback. On top of that, you had a compound with the Campa paired cells analysis where we weren't able to effectively cross-examine her. And even though we did cross-examine her, we were prevented from bringing in all of the evidence to present to the jury.
Counsel, assuming Robinson doesn't apply, I was wondering if your expert's calculation was nevertheless wrong. Would you revisit for me the calculation by your expert?
Okay, I'll have to do that off the top of my head, so I'll come as close as I can, as I believe. Our expert came in at $586,000 for the whole property. He gave a evaluation based upon the highest and best use of $65 a square foot. In my recollection, this front part of the property is only about 2,000, 3,000 square feet, and this may be where you're headed. And so the valuation was diminished by 10%. So if the property was worth 65 times, I'll just say 3,000 for quick calculations, 200,000, then it would only have been worth $20,000 as a take. So even though if the property as a whole was worth 20,000, because the setback existed, it would only be worth about $20,000. So that's the way I would answer that, Your Honor, unless you think I didn't get to your analysis.
Well, I just didn't see how your appraiser adjusted for the existing setback.
Well,
considered an oft-used argument that you use a square footage value across the full amount of the property, regardless of where the setbacks may exist or easements may exist.
Let me demonstrate how we did that.
Okay.
Because on the east side, which doesn't have the setback, Your Honor, mm-hmm. he gave a 70% value for that. So we're taking part of the east side of the property, we're taking part of the north side of the property. And his diminution of the value of the taking is less for the east side where there is no setback as opposed to the north where the setback exists. So he clearly, in my mind, accomplished that task of trying to differentiate. And so for that, well, one of my time's up, and so I'll appreciate it unless you have any questions. I'll turn it over to Mr. Harrop.
Thank you very much, Mr. Perry. Ms. Harrop,
good afternoon, may it please the court. My name is Stacey Harrop, and I'm representing Respondent Three Kids, which is the landowner in this case. I think I would actually like to take the jury instruction first and then go back to the Paracels. I think Robinson is on all fours here. Robinson was purposely written very broadly. It could have very easily have been written just to apply to future dedications, but it wasn't. What the court said is that a fact finder should determine the value of the portion in relation to the value of the whole based on the whole property's highest and best use. Therefore, it is improper for a fact finder to focus solely on the condemned portion when determining its value. Here, that's exactly what Nevada Power's appraiser was doing. He determined a value across the whole property of $65 a square foot. He then looked at the easement on the east side, which doesn't have a setback, and applied, I believe it was a 75% diminution there, and then the front easement, he applied a 10% diminution, basically determining that the front easement was only worth $6.50 a square foot. The only way you can get there is by reducing the value based on just a governmental restriction that only applies to that portion of the taking. And I think that's exactly what Robinson was getting at, that you can't do, that what you're supposed to do is value the property as a whole. You look at everything that applies to the property. You look at its zoning. You look at its setbacks. And then taking all that into account, you come up with one number, and that applies across the board. And I think that also takes into the reality of how property is bought and sold in the marketplace, which is what the jury's instructed to do when, in eminent domain cases. They're supposed to look at what a reasonably prudent buyer would look at when determining the market value of the property. And Ms. Camba actually testified to this as well, that she said this is how buyers value property. They look at everything, and they come up with one number that takes into account that everything. They don't slice up the property according to this part has a setback, that part doesn't, and so on. And I think that's really what the court was trying to get at in Robinson. I also don't think there was really a demonstration of prejudice here, even if that jury instruction was error. Again, Campbell testified how buyers and sellers value property in the marketplace, and that was what the jury was instructed to do.
Given your reading of the case, isn't that inconsistent with the jury instruction? The jury instruction says they require the value of the property as a whole, good enough so far. Then it goes on to say, and not put a lesser value on the portion of the property to be condemned based upon any governmental restrictions. But there were existing governmental restrictions. So isn't an appraiser in valuing the whole property to consider any existing restrictions?
Absolutely. I agree with you on that point. The jury actually got information about the setbacks in this case, about the zonings, about everything that applied to the property. None of that was stricken. None of that
this
was rejected.
This instruction tells the jury they're not supposed to take that into account.
It sounds
like they're being told to value the property for a gross dollar sum without regard to restrictions. Isn't that what it's saying?
I believe what the instruction says is that you can't devalue just a portion based on a restriction that applies solely to that portion. And perhaps your question also gets to, there's other jury instructions here that instructed the jury as well. And one of them was jury instruction number 26, which told the jury you're to consider any element of value which a reasonable and informed buyer of property similar subject would take into consideration. And that's where you look at, you take everything into consideration, and that's how you come up with that number.
It sounds like that's a conflicting jury instruction. On the one hand, they're told to value the property based on what a buyer would take into account, presumably existing setbacks, but then they're told to disregard any existing governmental restrictions in deciding value. Doesn't that seem internally inconsistent?
And I understand your concerns, but I have to say no. What the jury was told to do is they couldn't put different values on strips of the property. They had to come up with a value that was went across the whole property, regardless of where the square footage ended up, whether it was in the front, whether it was in the back. And coming up with that one number that applies across, you can look at everything. But when you're just talking about the specific portion, you can't say that that's less than the back portion because the setback's here. You can look at the setback and coming up with that one number that goes across the property, but you can't say the frontage is worth less because that's where the setback sits.
Well, I'm not sure Robinson even says that. Do you think that that's what it says?
Well, I think what Robinson says is that you're not supposed to reduce a portion to be condemned based on a restriction that applies just to that portion. In that case, they were looking at a future dedication.
Maybe Robinson isn't a picture of clarity, but...
I agree, Robinson's probably not the picture of clarity, but I think... I'm not saying it's absolutely on all fours here. This is a bit of an extension of Robinson. It's a new set of facts, and it's certainly one that is properly before this court.
Well, we can agree what it does say. It is improper for a fact finder to focus solely on the condemned portion when determining its value. From that sentence, instruction 35 is correct?
Well, I think it goes on to say it's improper for that you should determine the portion in relation to the value of the whole is sort of the lead into that, which I think is where the jury instruction comes from, is those two sentences together.
Well, I understood Robinson to say that you're to address this in the context of highest and best use, and the parties in this case stipulated to the highest and best use of the property, did they not?
The parties did not stipulate to the highest and best use.
Oh, excuse me.
But the problem here is what the appraiser did is he said highest and best use industrial across the property. But then he goes and takes the frontage and says, well, that's worth 90% less than the rest of the property. But that's not really applying the highest and best use to that portion now, is it? Because now we have a significantly reduced value, even though the rest of the property that is industrially says is $65 a foot. I mean, it sort of was a lip service to the highest and best use, I think, when he devalued that one portion of the property.
Well, the $65 per square foot figure was applied to the whole property, correct?
Correct.
And that was arrived at after taking into account the existing restriction.
That was arrived at, but then he went on to say the easement didn't take very much. But you can only get there, and perhaps it would help if I backtracked a little bit. There's also jury instruction 19, which instructed the jury how to value the easements. And they said you have to look at the value of the property before, and then you look at the property value of the property after with the easement in place, subtract those out, you get the value. So how can you get to the front easement being worth less than the east easement? The only way we get there is if the before value is less.
I didn't read either expert's report to offer any insight to the jury on instruction 19. Is that correct?
I apologize, Your Honor. I don't think I
didn't read either expert's report to offer the jury any insight on instruction 19. Is that correct?
I don't believe either appraisal report helps in that manner, no.
And I'm going to clarify. When we're talking about appraisal reports, my understanding of the record may be incorrect. In fact, I assumed that there was one appraisal report and then a review of the appraisal report by the utility. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor, there was an appraisal report by the landowner's appraiser. There was an appraisal report by Nevada Power's appraiser, and then there was also rebuttal reports that reviewed Ms. Campa's appraisal.
So they had courts that did a separate and distinct analysis of the value of the property?
Yeah, Nevada Power had another appraisal that did a separate analysis of the property, and that was Glenn Anderson's report. There were two Anderson experts, which makes it a little confusing. One Glenn and one was Rural. Thank you. I think I'd like to move on. I seem to have limited time to talk about the credit analysis 1 through 5. I think I'd like to start with explaining what they didn't try to exclude. They didn't try to exclude Tammy Campa herself. They didn't try to exclude the whole report. They didn't try to exclude her paired sales A through H. They didn't try to exclude her discussions with market participants or the other studies she relied on, all of those which she used to get to her severance damage number, the ultimate number which they also didn't try to exclude. The only thing they wanted to exclude was paired sales 1 through 5 was just a portion of her severance damage analysis, the things that she relied on to get there. And that obviously this goes to prejudice. Even if there was a problem here, her number still would have gotten in. The jury obviously believed that there was damage to this property. Otherwise, they would not have found a damage number at all. The only evidence that Nevada Power put in on severance damages was that transmission lines never damaged property. Having come to the conclusion there was damage, they relied on Tammy Campa's 10% number, which was supported by many things other than the paired cells 1 through 5.
There was no restriction on review of expert records, Ms. Campa's expert records, reports, work files, or the taking of her deposition. Is that a fair statement? In other words, they had every utilities had every opportunity to review, to test all of her reports and analyses.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Her report was disclosed in October 2009. They did reports in December of 2009. They took her deposition in March of 2010. The first time we ever heard that they had an issue was during the middle of her direct testimony in June of 2010. There was no motion in limine. There was no further discovery. During her deposition, they were very careful not to ask her what the APM numbers or addresses were. They just asked her if she gave them to them and if she thought she should have, but they never actually asked for the information. It was a very well thought out plan. Unfortunately, it backfired from Nevada Power, and I don't think they should be rewarded on appeal for a strategy choice that went bad. And I also would like to point out, I do believe that the district court got it correct. Tammy Campa disclosed her report that contained the paired cells, and it contained what she believed was the basis for her opinion. Whether Nevada Power thinks that that wasn't detailed enough to support that opinion, that really is a question of weight, not admissibility. And I think the court was correct in that. And the court also, in order to eliminate any prejudice, they said, well, your rebuttal experts are already attending her testimony. If they see something that happens that needs additional questioning, or they think there's other areas to explore, you are at liberty to recall Tammy Campa for additional questioning and cross-examination at any time. They were given lots of leeway to make sure their due process rights were not violated in the court. And just real quickly on the deposition issue, there was a question whether that deposition was tried to be introduced by Nevada Power for impeachment purposes. My review of the record is it was not. It was to be played as an adoptive admission in lieu of live testimony, which I think the district court has wide discretion to determine how a trial should proceed, particularly when you have a live witness on the stand available for cross-examination. It didn't seem appropriate to play the deposition in lieu of taking that live cross-examination. And I think the district court did not abuse its discretion in determining that. All right. There was one more point, the new rebuttal reports. During trial, they tried to admit, and I want to be clear about exactly what it was they tried to admit. It was new calculations based on net versus gross acreage of the cells and repaired cells 1 through 5. It was a very narrow issue that was excluded, and it was excluded because they had never disclosed it before. There was a map. There was new testimony on these calculations, and the district court was very consistent in that she said previously that in order to protect you in case, you know, this is new information because I can't really tell, what you get to do is you get to consult with your experts after they watch her testimony, and you can recall her again. She never said you could produce new information to rebut. So I think she had been very consistent in her rulings across the trial, which was not an abuse of discretion, because she had already put into place certain ways to protect Nevada Power based on their arguments that they were getting new information for the first time.
But it is the case that the first time they were provided with the APN numbers on the paired sales locations was during trial.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Her report disclosed the cross streets. It disclosed the general location they were in. They had a full opportunity to talk to her in her deposition. During her deposition, she reminded counsel that she had used these paired sales in other cases with the same counsel, the same party. And she also testified that she had the APN in her work file. It wasn't date stamped, so I'm not going to argue the point that is it wasn't. All I can say is that there was sworn testimony from the expert that it was in her work file and was available to them had they asked for it. But to say that they never knew where these sales were, I really have a hard time believing, particularly given the history between counsel in Nevada Power and this particular expert and her use in other cases.
Thank you, Mr. Perry. I know you did use up all your time, but we had some questions, so I'm going to give you a minute to sum up your position.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Let me just address the last comment, is that it is without doubt in the record, and I will assert that we did not know the location of the paired sales analysis until trial. And the fact that these were used in another report, after the fact, I looked it up. It's true. But I did not know that at the time of trial. I did not have that information at the time of trial. That was the first time when she said, oh, we already had this. We did not have all of the significant information that is required. And, Your Honors, the appendix is 2071 and 2072. These are the paired sales analysis information. This is all that exists up to trial. And so the comment is a little bit, I want to be advised here, a little advice myself, but it's a little offensive to say that that information is already available to us. It was not. It never was made available until trial. So we never until trial had the address, the APN, the seller, the buyer, the actual date, the sales condition, the comparison of the property, or the size of any of the parcels, not until trial. And then all we had was the APN, and we had to go out and find that information ourselves as a rebuttal.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right.
Sure. Is there no question?
Sure, go ahead, Mrs. Sada.
Has Ms. Campbell been admitted before the courts this jurisdiction prior to this trial, and if so, how many times? So it's a yes or a no with a number after it.
The answer is before the eighth judicial district court, yes, and I imagine, at least to my knowledge, four or five times. Maybe there could be more. I mean, that would be just my
knowledge. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel for your excellent arguments and briefs. We will take the matter under submission. We'll have a brief recess to reconstitute the court. Mm-hmm.